and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the vulnerability of U.S. election systems to a possible concerted effort by Russian intelligence to influence the outcome of the November election that Senator Feinstein and Congressman Schiff of the Intelligence Committees have warned is happening. An expert on the machinery and operations of U.S. elections, Pamela Smith, the president of Verified Voting, joins us to discuss the narrow window Russia would have to alter the election, which lies in states that have paperless DRE machines that only give electronic results and could be hacked without verification. Most, Louisiana, South Carolina, Delaware, and New Jersey, are not swing states, but Georgia could be, and Pennsylvania is an important swing state, with half of the state having vulnerable voting machines, as well as some of Virginia. But given the earlier intrusion into Arizona's and Illinois' voting rolls by a foreign power, if the Russians wanted to alter the rolls as new voters register in October or gum up the works and sow confusion on election day, they could manipulate the voting rolls, which Homeland Security is aware of and is trying to prevent. Then we will speak with David Satter, who has written about Russia for almost four decades and is a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and author of The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin, and advisor to former Republican presidential candidate Governor Kasich of Ohio. He is skeptical of speculation that Trump is owned by Putin, but believes that Putin's main focus is to convince the Russian people, whose brief window of democracy he has closed, that democracies in the West are corrupt and hypocritical and can be manipulated. Then finally, just before the first presidential debate begins, we will assess how much Donald Trump has lowered expectations and how much weight is on Hillary Clinton's shoulders to not only win over a lot of Americans who have been conditioned to dislike her, but to save her supporters from the specter of a Trump presidency that terrifies them. David Graham, a staff writer for The Atlantic, joins us to discuss his article at The Atlantic, How Trump Lowered Expectations for a First Debate, and how this debate is likely to be about personality and not policy. And joining us now is Pamela Smith, who's the president of Verified Voting, where she provides information and public testimony on verified voting issues at federal and state levels throughout the U.S., including to the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on House Administration. She is co-editor of The Principles and Best Practices in Post-Election Audits and co-author of Counting Votes 2012, A State-by-State Look at Election Preparedness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pamela Smith.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as you know, Pamela, the results of the, here we are just an hour away from the first presidential debate, and the polls are very tight. And when polls are tight and there's a very narrow margin to determine who the winner is, that's when any sort of mendacity in terms of trying to manipulate the results could actually work. Obviously, if you try to rig an election and it's a landslide for one of the candidates, you'd have a hard time rigging it, wouldn't you? I mean, that's a fundamental premise going into this discussion.
Yeah, I think that's where the concern arises. If you look at histories of close elections, you know, that's what I think where people have the most concern. How do you know is the question, right? How do you know? One person said, the important thing about elections is convincing the losers that they lost.
Well, indeed. And as we know, the minority chairs of both the Senate and House Intelligence Committees have gone public warning that from the briefings that they've received, the classified briefings they've received, that they believe that Russian intelligence is involved in a concerted effort to influence our elections. And they also went on to say that they believe the orders have come from the very top, presumably meaning Vladimir Putin. So if this is true, with your understanding of, and of course the main point to make is that we don't have a national election system. We have state by state, county by county systems, all of which are different and rely on different kind of voting machines. If the concerns expressed by the minority chairs of this House and Senate Intelligence Committees are valid, what could the Russians do to manipulate the vote on November 9th, whenever the election's over and the results are coming in.
Right. So I think it's important to know that the voting machines themselves are typically not connected to the internet. So a remote attack on voting machines would be, you know, inordinately challenging. You would really need to have some measure of access. The question is, you know, whether there was prior access, whether there's, you know, been any sort of virus or anything like that that might be overlooked. So what you want in a voting system is you want a way to be able to go back and check that the outcome was correct, that the votes were being counted correctly. And to do that, you need independent records, records that are independent of the software. In other words, a physical ballot that the voter marked, and the voter knows who they want to vote for. They look at the ballot, they say, oh, there's my candidate, and they make the mark on the page. And their checking of that makes it an indelible record of their intent. When you have that, you have a way to go back and reconstruct what an outcome should have been, even if your counting system went completely haywire. Even if you're not sure if the counting system went completely haywire, you have that fallback to go back and check. And that's true whether it's tampering with the election or whether it's simple malfunction, you know, something went wrong with the ballot programming. If you have those records of voter intent, those ballots, you have a way to go back and check. Where we have concerns are, you know, there are states where that isn't the case. You know, there are states where the ballots are not physical, they're electronic. And, you know, one thing we know about those ballots and those states is that they're concentrated in several states, you know, the areas where there are paperless voting machines that don't give you that separate ballot. There are five states that use those exclusively, most of which are not typically considered swing states. One of them is Georgia. That's probably the closest to a swing state. The others are Louisiana and South Carolina and Delaware and New Jersey. But there is one state where it is more of a concern, and that's Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is more than half paperless voting machines. And Virginia, less of a concern now. They have a few paperless voting machines remaining, but not nearly as many as they used to. So what this means is that you really have narrowed the window of opportunity for someone who wants to tamper with elections by way of the voting machines to a very small, narrow group of municipalities or counties or states, right? You would have to really be able to be having access to systems in these particular jurisdictions. And so that does make it much harder.
Well, Pamela Smith, though, we already had evidence of foreign, and I believe Russian, hacking or whatever you want to call it, in terms of Arizona and Illinois. That's according to Homeland Security. There have been intrusions.
Correct.
And these are intrusions into the voter rolls, which are online, right?
So, yeah, they were working on breaching the voter registration databases in those instances. So you have every state has a computerized voter registration database. Since 2002, that was a requirement that was part of the Help America Vote Act. So all of the states put together a statewide computerized voter registration database. And some states allow online registration, and some allow online lookup tools where you can look up your registration, or if you have an update, you moved, you can update your registration. So that varies from one state to the next. In Illinois, the breach happened through one of those public-facing interfaces, right, through the website itself where you would go and look up your registration. And in the case of Arizona, it was different. It was a case of somebody obtaining credentials from someone in a county that was authorized to use the database or be in it or make updates to it, but they didn't do it through a breach of a public website. Instead, they used spear phishing, we think, and obtained credentials of someone and then used those credentials. In both instances, these appear to have been foreign sponsored, and that's been confirmed by various entities. In particular, the FBI made note of it. So, that's a big concern. But it's important to note the separateness of the voter registration databases and systems from the actual voting machines. Now, where this becomes a problem in the voter registration system is, in most of the states, there are deadlines for when voters must be registered in order to vote this November. And not all states, some states do allow same-day registration, but for most of the states, there's a deadline. There's a deadline because the election officials have to get the voter rolls ready for going out to the polling places. So they have a cutoff date, and you need to make sure that your voter registration is up to date and intact by that deadline, or you don't get to vote in November. And in most cases, those are happening in October. They vary from one state to another. But it's important to know about this because voters can check their registration, and they should check it now before the deadline to make sure that it's correct and that there wasn't anything changed or that their registration hasn't disappeared. The good thing about voters doing that, especially if voters do it in large numbers, is if there are any problems, the voter contacting the election official to say, hey, how come my registration isn't in there anymore, will be an early warning. And we do know that there have been a number of efforts, including involvement from the Department of Homeland Security and others, to help states make sure that their voter registration data is intact and that their systems are not, that there aren't gaping holes in them, that they're not vulnerable. In the event that a state like, not Arizona or Illinois probably, but one of the other states in November were to find that there were a breach in their voter registration data, it's going to be problematic, but it's not going to be, it may not be so problematic that it affects the outcome, but it would definitely be problematic and it would be disruptive. And that's something we want to avoid. So the fact that these breaches happened in June and July rather than September and October is actually a good thing because it gave everyone a heads up to say, wow, that could actually happen here. We'd better make sure. So the election officials I've been speaking to are taking extra steps, have been conferring some of them with DHS, including election officials in Pennsylvania in particular, took DHS up on their offer to provide additional resources and cybersecurity, do vulnerability scans and that kind of service for the state.
So we've established then that the electronic results, the states with paperless electronic DRE machines, are the ones that would be vulnerable. And those states are Georgia, which is sort of some, to some extent a swing state, I guess, Louisiana, South Carolina, Delaware, and New Jersey. None of those are swing states. Pennsylvania, half of the machines are paperless. And Virginia, which is another swing state along with Pennsylvania, a much smaller fraction. Mm-hmm. But what we've just been talking about, Arizona and Illinois hacks from a foreign intruder, allegedly the Russians, what about the possibility of just gumming up the works on election day? In other words, if they don't want to tip the scales for one candidate, the intruders, could they just gum up the works? Because one of the theories, and this has been put forth, I believe, by some of the leaks from the Intelligence Committee, that it may not be so much about determining the election for Donald Trump as just letting the Russian people know that the American system is, in other words, it's in Putin's interest to tell his own people that democracies are corrupt because he's trying to distract them from the fact that he has corrupted Russian democracy and essentially stolen it.
I think there's something to that. I think there's a real issue here if you can point to, what's supposed to be the largest democracy and say, look, we can mess with their systems or somebody can mess with their systems. We won't say it was us. Disruption is a problem, partly because it concerns voters. It leaves voters with this feeling of, well, I can see what's happening here. This is disruptive. What else has been disrupted? And that's what we don't want. What what's really most important here is that voters have to pull together and say, I'm going to show up no matter what. I'm going to show up no matter what kind of voting system there is. I'm going to show up and vote. If my name is not on the voter rolls, I'll vote a provisional ballot and make sure it gets taken care of once Election Day is over so that my vote can be included. It's going to require effort. It's going to require a will to sort of overcome that kind of disruption. One of the things that could happen in the event that some, you know, that names were removed or modified or something from the voter rolls, you know, we think that's probably not likely, but in the event that that happened, every voter who comes to the polling place and believes that they should be on the voter rolls in that polling place, they have a right to cast what's called a provisional ballot. And the provisional ballot simply means that once you've cast it, there's information that goes on an envelope, then that ballot goes in that envelope, and it gives the election official a way to go back and double check. You know, did we have something wrong? Were you actually supposed to be on the voter rolls? Were we just, you know, changed your polling place? You know, whatever it might have been. And they use that information to adjudicate those ballots. Once they've adjudicated the ballot, if you were found to be a legitimate voter and on the voter rolls, then they count it. But if not, then it wouldn't be counted. In either instance, it's, you know, there's an expected number of provisional ballots that would be used on Election Day. You know, there's a ballpark figure that election officials prepare for. They know that a certain number of people will show up and will vote a provisional ballot. And if that number suddenly skyrockets, you know, if it goes up, if there's many more provisional ballots than in the past, A, they could run out of provisionals. They could probably get those replaced pretty quickly, but that would be a problem. B, it would mean a lot more work adjudicating those ballots after election night. Those votes will be added into the totals. So the election night totals are the unofficial totals, right? It's important to note that. So if you had a close election, you'd be waiting to hear what the final official total was. But it could add, you know, exponentially to the workload if something happened to the voter rolls like that. The reason we think it's a long shot is most jurisdictions are keeping a sort of a master copy of the voter data. They're keeping it offline. They have a printed copy as a backup. When they make updates, they, you know, carefully update the master, but they keep it offline. So your update, as you send it in, hey, this is Pam, I moved, here's my new address, that doesn't go directly through some online channel to the master copy. It goes through a process before it gets added to that master copy. And as a result, there's sort of some built-in checks and balances that keeps that data away from tampering, right? So that's one thing that makes it seem like, you know, and especially if voters are checking to make sure that the registration is up to date, that that's going to help. But yes, you don't want that kind of disruption on Election Day. You want everything to go as smoothly as possible on Election Day.
But in terms of the rolls, and we've established that the intrusions in Arizona and Illinois were in terms of the rolls and the registration rolls. So, and since the registration deadlines are going to be beginning, some of them, I think, have already begun, but they're mostly in October.
Right.
And that would mean that if you interfered early, you'd, what, be denying the new voters that are coming to the rolls, either young millennials who Hillary Clinton's trying to win over that supported Donald Trump. And, of course, I think Donald Trump himself is bringing out a lot of first-time voters who are disgusted with the system and see him as an agent of change.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, there are a lot of people who are interested in participating perhaps for the first time. An experienced voter may know, hey, things come up, there are problems, sometimes there are challenges. You know, maybe every year you have a challenge voting, but someone who's new to the process, you know, may not be as aware of things like registration deadlines and of the kinds of information that they need to be up to date on and aware of in order to be able to participate. So, yeah, it absolutely could affect newer voters and younger voters, particularly. So that's a concern. I'm scanning a list of voter registration deadlines now, and I'm seeing dates like as early as October 9th in Alaska, as late as October 24th in Alabama. Arizona is the 10th, October 24th for California. So there's a number of different dates that we're seeing. Connecticut, it's as late as November 1st.
Sure.
I think they vary quite a bit.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of the mail-ins. They're starting now. But finish up, if the Russians were trying to flip the election for Trump, they've only got half of Pennsylvania and a bit of Virginia and possibly Georgia. So they've got a pretty narrow window, unless their real intention is just to screw it up and there's a lot of other mendacious things they could do. Is that an accurate summary?
I think that's a fair thing to say, yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Pamela Smith.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Pamela Smith, who's president of Verified Voting, where she provides information, public testimony on verified voting issues at federal and state levels throughout the U.S., including to the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on House Administration. She is the co-editor of The Principles and Best Practices in Post-Election Audits and the co-author of Counting Votes 2012, A State-by-State Look at Election Preparedness. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the most likely reason Putin is trying to undermine the American election.
They don't believe me, but you won't let those robots defeat me. Those evil natured robots, they're programmed to destroy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Satter, who has written about Russia for almost four decades. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. His previous books, all published by Yale University Press, include Darkness at Dawn, and his latest book is The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Satter.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
And I've been looking into the possibility, and certainly the rumors are fairly rife, that Donald Trump could be Putin's Manchurian candidate, or as to put it more bluntly, could be Putin's bitch. But I had Karen DeWisher on yesterday, who's a student of Russia and wrote Putin's Kleptocracy, along with a former senior NSC staffer, Roger Morris, who is writing a comparative history on the U.S. and the USSR in terms of their inner workings based on declassified documents and access to a lot of senior KGB people, including a KGB general that he was just with over the weekend. So it was pretty alarming, but both of them said that that there is, as you know, the chairs or the minority chairs of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees have both gone public warning that from the briefings that they've had access to, they're concerned that Russian intelligence is trying to interfere with our elections. So since you've written this book that in many ways explores how Putin came to power via the bombing of the apartment buildings on the outskirts of Moscow, I guess the premise I would proceed with this interview, David, is that if Putin is capable of killing his own citizens in order to advance his personal power, then he's certainly capable of interfering in our elections.
Well, I think that's, the fact that he's capable of doing it is undeniable. The fact that it's the kind of thing that the Russians would be tempted to do and that they've done in the past in other countries is also undeniable. Whether or not that's exactly what's happening now is another matter. Because I think that, in fact, Well, there are two things to bear in mind. First of all, oftentimes Russians and Russian intelligence act not so much with an eye to the United States, but with an eye to the internal situation in Russia. And as such, if, for example, they try to interfere with the campaign of one or another candidate, or if they try to discredit a candidate, it may well be to demonstrate to the Russian internal audience how corrupt the electoral process is in the United States. You have to bear in mind that in Russia there hasn't been a real election, and certainly not an honest election, since 1990. Under these circumstances, the appearance of two candidates, or actually four candidates is what we have in the States, competing vigorously and openly for the presidency is enough to make Russians wonder about their own country. And that's dangerous from the point of view of the leadership. So if for example, there's a leak, and if Russia's behind it, that shows that there are unfair practices in the Democratic National Committee and that the nomination was fixed to a certain extent, or at least the cards were stacked against one or another of the candidates, that's exactly the kind of message that the Russian authorities want their people to hear. They want them to think that, yes, of course, it's a corrupt system here, but it's just as corrupt in the United States. Now, we don't know who stands behind these leaks, whether it is Russian intelligence, whether it's hackers who are connected with Russian intelligence, whether it's independent hackers. But let's assume for a moment that it is, and that the Russians are intent on releasing this kind of information. Their motive may not be what we think it is. Their motive may be to convince their own citizens that the American electoral process is corrupt. The idea that Trump is a Manchurian candidate, that he's working for the Russians, doesn't play very well with me. First of all, I think that that's being used for political reasons by the Clinton side. When Hillary became Secretary of State, it was in the wake of the murder of Anna Politkovskaya, the leading Russian investigative reporter, and the nuclear poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko in London, and the indications that the Russian regime was behind both of those killings were so clear and undeniable that it's really unbelievable almost that she and the Obama administration began the policy of reset, which was based on assumptions about the Russian regime that had no relationship to reality. Now, after ignoring the evidence, including the evidence of the apartment bombings, which was presented to them repeatedly, they're now saying that, in fact, that the Russians are desperate to prevent a victory by the same people who ignored the reality of Russia during the entire eight-year period that the Obama administration has been involved in that question. I don't think that the Russian authorities see that much difference between Trump and Clinton. It's true, of course, that Trump has made statements that are really shocking in their stupidity. It's also true that he has offered responsibility, or at least there are reports that he offered responsibility for foreign policy to John Kasich. If Kasich would run as vice president, and Kasich had a position which is diametrically opposed to the positions that Trump is taking now. I know that because I was an advisor to Kasich and I helped formulate those positions. So my feeling about Trump is that he doesn't really know very much about anything, and he will be influenced by whoever he chooses as advisors, and also by the intelligence information that he will have access to. And I think the Russians think that too. So I think that all this talk of Manchurian candidate and so on is a little bit self-serving on the part of the Clinton side. It doesn't mean that the Russians aren't trying to interfere in the election, but I don't think they have a strategy to elect one or another of the candidates. I think that what's taking place, if they're interfering, is an attempt to discredit the elections in the eyes of the Russian people. And they are much more concerned about that audience than we might think.
Of course, the relationships between Obama and Putin went downhill, I think, in many ways, because I don't think the U.S. ambassador was up to the task. McFaul, Obama got bad advice. I mean, why he dealt with Medvedev instead of Putin is just mind-boggling. Hillary, of course, made that outrageous remark that Putin, comparing Putin to Hitler, which is something you do not do to Russians because of the history of the 26 million that died in World War II, etc. So I think we can agree that the relationship has been mishandled. But the point about Putin, though, is, as you've made clear, they have what is euphemistically called a managed democracy in Russia. The real question is Putin trying to spread that kind of pseudo-democracy in a cynical way around the world, in particular in Western Europe? He's backed right-wingers or far-right-wingers like Nigel Farage and Le Pen in France and Jobbik in Hungary, etc. And that's the concern that a lot of people have, is that he's destabilizing. For example, when he went into Syria, shortly after his intervention in Syria, suddenly there was this massive outflow of refugees, which was our Joint Chiefs of Staff described as the weaponization of refugees. And you know what that has had, the ramifications of that in Europe have been, and it may in many ways have led to the Brexit vote. So this is what concerns me about Putin, is that it's one thing to, you know, destroy democracy in your own country and have a pseudo-democracy, but it's another thing to basically destroy democracies in Western Europe and interfere with a democracy here in the United States.
Well, there's a relationship here, because what exists in Russia is the monopolization of power and wealth by a very small group, a very small corrupt group that is determined to hang on to that power and to hang on to that wealth. And their form of rule, which is based on corruption and intimidation, is incompatible with integration in any Western institutions. And in fact, the influence of the West is a form of pressure on them, because the population may respond to it. As a result, anything that can destabilize the West, that can cause problems for the West, is going to be viewed favorably by the Russian regime. What is, I think, really important for us to bear in mind, though, is that as much trouble as they may create for us, this regime is a much more serious long-range threat to its own people. It can't work in the long run, because it stifles any type of initiative and economic progress, and it runs completely counter to the growing sophistication of the Russian middle class that has developed despite all obstacles in the period since the Soviet Union collapsed. And so they're the seeds there of an internal crisis. And that crisis, much more than efforts to destabilize Western countries, as bad as they are, represents the real danger for the world. Because a serious crisis in nuclear-armed Russia, a serious internal crisis, in which the regime has demonstrated that it's ready to use terrorism against its own people. In fact, it came to power, as I explain in the book, as the result of an act of terror carried out against its own people. The danger that represents is really, I think, where we ought to be focusing our minds.
Well, in the interview yesterday with the former senior NSC staffer Roger Morris, who's writing this, or completing this book on the inner workings of both the USSR and the US during the Cold War, Kindred Rivals, it's called, he made the point that from his KGB contacts or SVR, FSB contacts in Russia, that there's tremendous dissent. You talk about dissent was in Russia and sophistication. The KGB was one of the more sophisticated organizations in Soviet Russia, certainly had more power and influence than the CIA would ever have here. And he was making the point that from his context, there's a great deal of disquiet about this project underway to destabilize the U.S. elections, which apparently they spent over $1 billion on. A lot of the younger officers are all aboard, chafing at the bit to do it. But the older, more seasoned ones are thinking that this is incredibly reckless. I recall Angela Merkel, after a long phone conversation with Putin after he'd annexed Crimea, wondering whether this guy's on the same planet. That's my concern, is that he's so obsessed with America, and he has this, he sees the world through a kind of KGB lens, that, you know, he plays a very weak hand strongly, and it looks like we play a very strong hand weakly, and that this is all he cares about. I mean, you're making the case that he's really more looking over his shoulder at home.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who the KGB sources are for that we're referring to, so I can't comment where that information came from, what it, you know, and you know how reliable it is. There's, you know, the Russians are good at putting out disinformation, but the core concern for the Russian authorities. Listen, they've started now four wars, or become involved in four wars, all to deflect the attention of the Russian population from the way in which the population is being misruled. The first Chechen war was to distract the population from the pillaging of the country during privatization. The second war, after the apartment bombings, was organized in order to bring Putin to power. The third war in Ukraine was undertaken to distract Russians from the lessons of the Euromaidan revolt. And the fourth war, in effect, the intervention in Syria, was undertaken to distract Russians from the failure of the intervention in Ukraine, or at least the problems in the intervention. So there's a very consistent pattern. I mean, Russia is not powerful enough to change the shape of the world. They're powerful enough to be a nuisance, and even a serious nuisance in certain critical situations. But they can't remake the world. This isn't the Soviet Union. What they can do is generate a real crisis in their own country because of their corruption and criminality. And remember, this is, you have to understand the mentality of a set of rulers who are ready to kill hundreds of randomly chosen people in order to come to power. That's a degree of cynicism with which people in the West are not really very familiar, so we try to interpret it always as something it isn't. But I think that their principal concern, I'm not saying that they don't take pleasure from and are not anxious to create problems internationally, but their principal concern is to make sure that the aggressivity of the population will be directed toward the outside world and not toward them. And I think that's what we're seeing. And it's just, I mean, if I don't think that there is a Russian plot to elect Donald Trump or to elect Hillary Clinton, one or the other, I think they're smart enough to understand that both candidates are pretty superficial, and that there will be, you know, that there will be some kind of consensus that'll be worked out whoever wins. But in terms of their desire to make sure that they continue to hold on to power in their own country, and that is really, in the long run, dangerous for the world because of who they are. I don't think there's any question about that.
But just in closing, since you mentioned that you have worked with John Kasich, it does seem, given what Ted Cruz just said a couple of days ago in finally endorsing Donald Trump, it seems that the Republicans are going along with the Trump train, getting aboard it, even though many of them have real doubts about him. I've heard the Republican leadership, like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, referred to as Vichy Republicans. It does seem that Kasich is a man of principle. I think there is a difference in terms of the two candidates, surely, when it comes to Russia. One of them at least has her eyes open, as you point out. The other one, Donald Trump, doesn't have a clue. And he has some business relationships that people are looking into. There's also rumors of that the FSB have honey trap videos, etc. So, and then 50 senior Republican national security experts wrote a very, very vociferous letter saying that he was somebody that they couldn't do business with, and that the IC and the foreign policy community, the defense and intelligence people, would almost mutiny if this guy were president. So something is going on.
Let me mention one thing that I heard. I have the same doubts about Trump. I thought that, I think that both Trump and Clinton and Hillary are terrible candidates, and there's no good result for the United States. But on the subject of Russia, and I know, as far as I understand, John Kasich at the present time is not going to vote for Hillary and hasn't decided what to do about Trump. What I did hear while I was in Ukraine just now is that Jim Woolsey, the Clinton's CIA director, has signed on as an advisor to Trump. I mention this because Woolsey persuaded John McCain, the only member of the U.S. Congress to raise the issue of the 1999 apartment bombings and how Putin came to power. So if Woolsey is an advisor to Trump, his views are totally diametrically opposed to the quite stupid things that Trump has been saying. And this gives me reason to think that, you know, a lot of this is campaign rhetoric that's going to be reevaluated. Otherwise, he wouldn't have an advisor like that, and he wouldn't have offered Kasich the foreign policy portfolio. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a dreadful situation, I think, given on the one hand, Clinton's record when she had full access to intelligence information, to endorse policies the way she did without thinking, does not recommend her. On the other hand, the statements that Trump is saying are so absurd that it's hard to believe that any normal candidate would make them. So, you know, given that choice, you know, the American people are sort of caught in the middle.
Right. And we will see what's on display tonight. And I thank you for joining us, David Satter.
All right. Thanks, and all the best to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Satter, who has written about Russia for almost four decades. He is a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and his previous books are all published by Yale University Press, include Darkness at Dawn, and his latest is The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the first presidential debate that's just about to begin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Graham, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National. And his latest article at The Atlantic is How Trump Lowered Expectations for the First Debate. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Graham.
Thank you.
And it's pretty clear that the Trump campaign have been really signaling heavily that they're trying to lower expectations, presumably because they think they can pull off a surprise. I mean, why would you lower expectations?
I think they understand that people have such a low bar for Trump coming in, given his record, that if they set the bar very low and they suggest that he's not doing well, then anything he does will appear to be exceeding his own standard, and that will make him look good and will score him at least maybe a tie in the debate in the media commentary afterward.
Well, as you point out in the article, of course, Trump, in his many interviews with Bill O'Reilly of Fox News, he derided the whole process by saying, look, it's a phony system. Then he went to talk. Then he talked about the moderator, NBC's Lester Holt. Trump said, Lester is a Democrat. I mean, they are all Democrats. Okay, it's a very unfair system. Of course, Trump, I guess he's since been told that Lester Holt is a registered Republican. Did that register or his people?
Well, you see him trying to paint Holt as out to get him, and he's trying to put the moderators on the defensive. And this comes after he threatened not to participate in the debates, and already, you know, according to some reports, may have influenced the selection of the moderators to choose people who he'd be more likely to accept. So you see, he's been working the system for a couple months now.
So do you think that Lester Holt is somebody he wants? I mean, does that suggest that these moderators are going to... I mean, they're not going to be as bad as Matt Lauer, I imagine, who lowered the bar beyond belief.
Holt seems like a little bit of a blank slate, you know? I mean, people respect him a great deal as a newsreader. How he might be in the debate is unclear. But I think people saw the choice of Chris Wallace as a potentially Trump-friendly choice, and you didn't see somebody like a Candy Crowley, who was so controversial in the debate between Obama and Romney, where she fact-checked Romney.
Well, and what about Martha Raddatz?
Raddatz is an interesting case. I mean, she's somebody who seems widely respected and I think came out of the 2012 cycle as probably the most heralded of the moderators for the job she did in the vice presidential debate, I believe. It's not clear exactly who Trump feared he might have gotten or who he might not have accepted.
So given that this is supposed to be, I think, the biggest, I'm not sure whether this is the biggest audience in history. It's the biggest presidential debate audience, upwards of 100 million. Wouldn't that be up there in terms of that, bigger than, you know, the Academy Awards and NFL Super Bowl?
Yeah, people are comparing it to the Super Bowl. Although I've also seen people pointing out that proportionally, by population, it would be a smaller portion than watched, for example, the famous 1960 Kennedy-Nixon debate.
And that leads me to the question about what these debates are really about, or what is retained from them, or what were the deciding factors. In the case of the Kennedy-Nixon debate, most historians agree that Nixon's 5 o'clock shadow did him in. We know that George H.W. Bush, when he was debating this young upstart from Arkansas, Governor Bill Clinton, kept looking at his watch as though he was bored and wanted to be somewhere else. And then, of course, we all remember Al Gore's strange antics of walking right up to George Bush, you know, challenging like some ruminant animal in the jungle. So what do you think? My sense is, David, that this debate tonight, coming up fairly soon now, will be really about personality and not about policy. That at the end of the day, Trump is doing well, I think, because people like his personality, and Hillary's doing poorly because they have this idea that she's corrupt and crooked Hillary, and that, you know, they've, to some extent, been conditioned not to like her. So if that's the case, she's got a pretty uphill battle tonight to make the American people like her.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a safe guess that this is more about personality. And obviously, it's hard to imagine what a policy debate would even look like, given Trump's lack of interest in policy. You know, the Clinton campaign likes to talk about how it has these 38 policy papers available, and of course, no one seems to be really bothered by that. Now, I think Clinton could potentially do very well, even in a personality debate, if she comes across as level-headed and on top of her game and can get Trump to sort of go off the rails. She's not going to win over any Trump supporters, but what she needs to do is win over some undecideds and convince people that they should get out to vote. But I would be surprised if there's a policy debate. I would say, you know, the track record, we remember those things about these debates so clearly. The track record for them having a lasting and definitive effect on polling is pretty minimal. So it's interesting to see whether this debate will be, you know, significantly different and really will affect the race.
David, just in the last day or so, I've been covering the possibility of Donald Trump being the Manchurian candidate. You know, there are all kinds of rumors swirling around in the intelligence community about the extent to which Russian intelligence is manipulating this election. And first of all, the most damaging information that's been released for Hillary Clinton has been the existence of her private servers, and that was first released by RT back in March of 2013. So there is a considerable amount of evidence that Russia's got a hand in trying to tip the scales in for Trump. And the minority heads of the Senate and House Intelligence Committee, Senator Feinstein and Adam Schiff, went public a couple of days ago saying that from the briefings that they'd gotten, they're concerned or in fact alarmed that Russian intelligence is trying to influence these elections and that the orders to do so would have had to come from the top. So is that something, do you think, might come up in this debate? I mean, or is this something that John Brennan and company are dealing with and don't want to talk about?
I think Clinton would like to talk about it. She released a debate overnight, I believe, which focuses on these Russian ties and the suggestion that Trump has business relations riding on good relations with Russia. So she's definitely wants to make something out of it. It's unclear to me how much sway that has. I mean, we have this long string of friendly comments that Trump has made about Putin, revelations of ties, and perhaps without that, Trump would be doing better, but you don't see that it's taken a significant chunk out of his support. People seem to, his supporters seem to generally think that's okay.
So, we talk about lowering the bar, right? I guess if you go around insulting everybody, then if you're vaguely civil, then you're a statesman.
Exactly.
Is that what it's come to?
It seems that way. I mean, we'll see. But the state seems to me that because of these low expectations, anything he does that doesn't, you know, isn't setting Clinton on fire on stage is going to be viewed as, well, that was a fairly measured performance by Trump.
Well, you know, the questions that have been leveled about Lester Holt, the moderator, are largely about whether or not he will do some fact-checking. And you get two versions of, he hasn't said anything himself, but you get two versions. One is that his job as a moderator is just to move the thing along and to make sure that they have equal time and to be a kind of referee. But the other school of thought is that because Trump has just said so many outrageous things and seems to lie with such alacrity, that it's incumbent upon Holt to fact-check him. So how do you think it's going to pan out?
I think that Holt will probably be forced to do at least a minimum amount of fact-checking just by what happened with his colleague Matt Lauer. If Trump gets up there and says that he opposed the Iraq war from the start, I think it'll be very hard for Holt not to say something simply because of the backlash and because people are so attuned to that. If he doesn't, he will look as though he has no interest in actually serving as a referee. You know, people use this referee metaphor, but a referee will generally blow the whistle if somebody is blatantly breaking the rules. I do think it's hard for a debate moderator to serve as a real, real-time fact-checker simply because there are so many claims made, and it's hard to, at the moment, present that information and go forward. Yeah, a moderator has to think very quickly and has to avoid being rolled by the candidate. So I suspect we'll see a little bit, but not a great deal, and maybe that's just too hard for most moderators to do.
Well, it would seem, though, that you could make the case, and many have, that one of the reasons why Trump is almost level with Hillary Clinton, if not level with her, is that the press, because of the binary nature of the press, you know, have created this, or are slaves to this kind of false equivalency, and that they haven't pulled him over, that they haven't fact-checked him, that they haven't held him to account, that he's actually been able to manipulate the press and get billions of dollars worth of free coverage.
I think it is both true that he has been able to manipulate the press, and also true that there has been a great amount of fact-checking, and it's sort of whether people want to seek it out. But, I mean, Trump appears to be a sort of post-truth candidate. He's not often making these claims, I think, with any intention of being taken all that literally. And his supporters don't really seem to care whether or not they are true. When you talk to Trump supporters, they often acknowledge that things he says are not strictly factually true. To them, that's not the most important thing. They're concerned about the stance and about standing up more than they are about whether or not the things he says are actually true, which, by and large, they are not.
So what does that say about the American people? I mean, is it about our declining education, or is it about a kind of tribalism? I can't put my finger on it.
I agree. I'm not quite sure what it means either.
Right. Well, it does seem, though, that, you know, Obama, I mean, I've never seen anybody with better surrogates than Hillary Clinton, but at the end of the day, it does come down to her. And I imagine that I've talked to people, actually, who aren't even going to watch the debate that's coming up very soon now, simply because they're so anxious. These are supporters of Hillary Clinton, that they're so anxious that they're going to have a nervous breakdown if she doesn't do well. So given that anxiety on the part of partisan viewers, what kind of pressure do you think there is on Hillary Clinton?
I think you have a great illustration of just how much pressure there is. And I think, you know, even if this debate doesn't make a great difference in the final result, if she delivers a poor performance, you will have people just absolutely panicking. I think about just how extreme the reaction was when Mitt Romney out-debated Barack Obama in the first debate 4 years ago, and that was a debate with a candidate who was not nearly as extreme as Romney, and in a situation where Obama looked like he was more in control. So you can imagine what it would be like if Clinton really delivers a poor performance. I think you'll see widespread panic, and I don't know what that means. I mean, you're not going to replace Clinton at this point on the ticket, but it will probably be a nauseating ride if she does poorly.
And conversely, since so many people have watched Trump, starting with the debates, the Republican primary debates, and then throughout all of his campaigns, they keep watching him in many ways, expecting a train wreck. And so far, it hasn't happened. So do you think that applies to Trump as well, that there'll be a lot of people waiting for him to implode or go off the rails?
Yeah, I think there's a sort of NASCAR element to it. You know, people are watching for the crashes. And the thing about Trump is he has had a few things that might have been crashes for other people. You know, I think it's his inability to identify the nuclear triad, for example, or his bragging about the size of his genitals. You know, these are things that for any other candidate would, in fact, be probably a candidacy-ending train wreck. But for Trump, they seem to just bounce right off of him. He walks out of the rubble and strolls away unharmed. So, you know, I think there's a certain amount of people who will just watch for the entertainment. What will Trump do? And, of course, that makes it easier for him to exceed people's expectations.
Well, David Graham, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Graham, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National. And his latest article at The Atlantic is How Trump Lowered Expectations for the First Debate. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also scroll down the right-hand side and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. But stay tuned now for the first presidential debate, followed by post-debate analysis from Amy Goodman and the Democracy Now! Team. Bye for now.